Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Welcome, everyone, to Episode 6 of the Golf Advisor Podcast. I'm Brandon Tucker, your host for today's podcast and the managing editor of Golf Advisor. Now, this is our last episode of 2018, and we're looking ahead to the new year by spotlighting some of the top trends we saw on the road throughout the year. Now, we've got a jam-packed discussion, so I want to get right to it. Joining me for this episode are two of my senior writers. Jason Deegan has been covering golf resorts and destinations worldwide since the early days of the internet. He's been pretty much everywhere, and that includes a trip this year to Uruguay, of all places. Also joining us is podcast regular Brad Klein, expert on golf course architecture, private clubs, and agronomy. Now, he also attended the Shinnecock U.S. Open, among other events this year in 2018. Now, Brad and Jason saw a ton this year, and I saw a fair amount myself, and we talk everything from turf to drones to driving ranges to short courses to new courses to close courses and a whole lot in between. We hope you enjoy our conversation, and be sure to subscribe to the podcast on your favorite pod provider like iTunes and Stitcher. Now, here's a look back on the top trends in golf courses and travel in 2018. So we're here with Brad Klein out on the Northeast coast, and we have Jason Deegan out in Silicon Valley, and I'm here in Texas. So we have the whole country covered, so to speak, for this podcast. And you guys covered a lot of ground in 2018. And you know, Jason and I, we've been working together for quite a while. And Brad, this was your first year with Golf Advisor, and I trust it exceeded your wildest dreams, huh?
It was very interesting. I learned a lot. It was enjoyable, and it's great working with colleagues who are doing similar but different compatible things. So it's made it a lot easier.
Certainly, and you've brought a lot of different expertise to the group. So why don't you share a little bit before we kick off talking about what we saw in 2018 with the event that you have going on in Florida this spring?
Well, you know, some of the big resorts are just amazing for their innovation. So obviously Stream Song is one of them. And I've spent a lot of time at Bandon Dunes, at Sand Valley, at Pinehurst, at Stream Song. And I was there at Stream Song when they added the black course about a year and a half ago now. So we're going to bring our followers at GolfAdvisor.com to Stream Song. And we're going to play all three courses, the blue, the red. The blue is Tom Doak, the red is Cor Crenshaw, and then the black is Gil Hands. Maybe we'll play the little six-hole par three course as well. And we're going to open it up, actually, warm it up with a trip to Mountain Lake, which is a very nice course in Lake Wales. So kind of a bonus, and should be an interesting few days. So that's the May 31st through April 3rd. And I'm looking forward to hosting, and I'm going to give a couple of talks and host and walk around and spend time with everybody. So we really think it's going to be a fun event.
Great. Yeah, I was on the Arcadia one with Dana Fry, and very illuminating, to say the least. And I know we recorded a podcast there, and maybe we'll do the same out of Stream Song. So, Jason, I want to kick it over to you and bring up a resort, a mysterious resort out in the Northwest that actually both of y'all have been to, Sylvie's Valley Ranch out in Oregon. And this is a fascinating place to me, you know, not only just reading y'all's dispatches from there, but it seems like this is a place that is really going the extra mile in terms of innovative stuff. You know, first and foremost, of course, you have the reversible golf course. You've got short courses. You've got that gauntlet course out there, which is meant to be really tough. Goat caddies. I don't know if goat caddies is a trend going forward, Jason, but you know, what's your takeaway from Sylvie's and going forward and what this means for destination golf?
I think what Sylvie's realized early on is, you know, they're so remote from anything else. It's 3 hours from Bend. There's no other golf course to play around the resort. So what they have has to be good enough to get you there and then entertain you for 2 to 3 to 4 days, however long you're going to stay. So that's why everything they've done is kind of over the top, really interesting. It's a beautiful kind of prairie, high desert setting with some mountain backdrops. You can debate all day long about which course you like better, the Hankins or the Craddock. I don't know about you, Brad. I kind of gravitated towards the original routing just because I think Dan Hixon. That's where he focused most of his attention early on, and it seems like the most natural routing to me. But really interesting place. The stargazing is amazing because you're, again, middle of nowhere. So any, you wear cowboy boots to go riding a razor, search the ranch. So just really different kind of golf outpost experience than most golf resorts. What'd you think of it, Brad?
I loved it. And I spent probably more time off the golf courses than I did. The golf courses were fine. I really enjoyed them. I was surprised how good they were, partly because they didn't try to come at each other's greens. You know, when they reversed, about 9-10 holes reverse, they came at it from different angles, as opposed to the loop in Michigan, which comes at from a 180-degree angle. And so that's harder to make work. So I like the variety of the holes, but I spent a lot of time in that razor running around. I must say I got my right side of my outfit, what I was wearing, got covered in cow poop because Scott there, the owner, was racing around and stuff was flying. But, you know, what the hell? It made for a good lead story.
You needed your rain jacket.
You're waterproof. I only needed the right side of the rain jacket. Anyway, the point is you got, I don't know how many, 175,000 acres out there. You got 4,000 heads of sheep and 3,000 goats. And the food is fabulous. They brought in a five-star chef from Bend who out there, and they've got the meat right there. It's all organically raised. And, we sell wild elk and antelope and the hiking and the fishing and all that stuff was fabulous. So, and I'm not one of those outdoor guys, but I spent a ton of time and I loved it. So it surprised me. And I thought the quality of the cabins was cool and the food was just great. So, all told, it made the 3-hour drive from Boise. You can go to Bend and fly and drive east, or you can fly to Boise and drive west. It was worthwhile. So I hope things work out for them. They're pretty remote. And but they've done everything they could to make that place worth the trip. So it's all you can hope for.
This concept of remote golf, I know Sand Hills is considered somewhat of a catalyst in that regard. And Bandon, of course, coming a couple years later. How many more super remote facilities like this do it takes some effort to get to, and the effort of the resort to get people there, it takes a lot of it. How many more of these types of resorts in North America do you think are out there?
Well, I may differ from some people. I don't think it's a model. Sand Hills works because they built it for $10 million. Bandon Dunes works because they spent about the same on the first opening stuff, and then everybody came and made it work. But you look at some of these other remote properties, they've struggled. Prairie Club, Dismal River, Ballyneal, Sutton Bay, for all different reasons. But they spent a lot more money than the initial at Sand Hills and Bandon. Now, I think Sylvie's Valley Ranch did it differently. The fella has deep pockets. They didn't spend a lot. They built everything in-house. So there's a chance. But my point is, I don't think it's a model. I think it's an exception. And it's got to be unique and special. And I thought that the Sylvie's was as unique and special as you could get. So maybe that's a different view from some people.
Jason, we were out at Ballyneal this year, actually, in September. And I know this is a course that opened, right before the recession. And it seems like really any facility that opened in like the early 2000s was kind of doomed from the get-go. But they've turned it around and they're doing well. So I think there is something to be said for remote facilities that really understand their demographic and get it right.
Well, their scale at Ballyneal is entirely appropriate. I mean, you're one of only, 60 people on property if the property is packed. So, they don't need to attract tons of people to make their business model work. And the golf course, like Brad said, it has to be special, and Balineal definitely delivers in that regard. So, you know, it's definitely a destination. If you can get access, either with a member or being a guest of a member. But, you know, they're only kind of one of a kind. There's only, what, 5 to maybe 10 in North America. Maybe one or two more can kind of find a way to make it work, but it's a long shot. So I don't know how many people are willing to invest that kind of money and effort into golf in this climate.
Plus, they got lobster mac and cheese. Now, that's special at Balineal.
The food was good there. I do remember that quite vividly. I want to go back to reversible golf, guys, because, you know, Jason, you've been to the Loop too. And reversible golf has really picked up steam in the last couple of years. And I know with Sylvie's and Forest Dunes, these are, you know, remote resorts that certainly, you know, they're not strapped for acreage. Brad, as you said, there's over, what, 175,000 acres out of Sylvie's. So you don't need to, shrink things. But what opened in Atlanta this year, the Bobby Jones course, which we sent one of our colleagues, Mike Bailey, to, and we'll be talking about more in 2019, the idea of municipal reversible golf, and in the case of Bobby Jones, they shrunk their footprint to essentially create a 9-hole reversible course on what was 18 holes. You know, Brad, I know you've did some research this year on reversible courses. I mean, do you think, let's say we've got a handful of them now, maybe 4, 5, 6, you know, we've got some flexible routings out there as well. I mean, do you think 10 years from now, 20 years from now, is reversible golf saving municipal golf?
No, it's not going to save it, but you're going to see more of them. And first is because from a marketing standpoint, it's great. You got one golf course of maintenance, but it's with some extra greens, but it's essentially, you got two golf courses. So if you played it once, now you got to go back and play it the next day. That's a great appeal. So it's not going to work probably in real estate areas because you've got a lot of concerns about right side and drifting and shots, and it's much harder to work there. You need a lot of room. And I don't think municipal is going to be the place to monitor it because you have to have some pretty strict rules about access and, you know, putting out the pins and so on. But it's a great, I've heard of more people who are trying to do it, architects early on at resorts, at casinos, for example. So I think we're going to see more, but it's got to be a new golf course. And so we know that the new golf course inventory is not great. It's probably 15 a year for the next few years. So how many of those are going to be reversible? Maybe 2 or 3, which would be nice.
You were out at the Loop, Jason. You know, I'm sad to say I haven't really played a reversible golf course yet. I did see a review come into Bobby Jones on Golf Advisor, you know, complaining of confusion. Are these confusing things? I mean, it's one thing if you're an architecture buff to understand reversible golf when you show up. I mean, I think when people go travel to play a Tom Doak course, they know what they're getting into. But is the muni golfer, I mean, can they tolerate and understand and appreciate reversible golf?
When on my round, on my second round on the Loop, my playing partner and I, who played the day before, we were utterly confused on one of the tee boxes. I can't remember what hole it was specifically, but you could see a green off to the right, but there was a fairway to the left with a green farther away. So we really had to dive into the scorecard and then the yardage guide before we finally figured out, hey, this is where we got to go. So there are definitely issues in that regard. You know, signage was critical. I thought Sylvie's Valley Ranch had a ton of signage, more so than the Loop, because the Loop really tries to be low key. I know that the Loop also wants you to take a caddy, which we didn't have. So, you know, there is some issues there, but you can easily overcome that, I think. And I find them intriguing enough to, I want to play as many reversible golf courses as I can.
Okay. Great. Yeah, I think we'll keep an eye on it. I mean, I was out at St. Andrews in April, and that's really the first reversible golf course, so to speak. And, you know, it's only a 70 or so acre golf course, if I'm not mistaken. And so the idea of, you know, making more golf out of a small footprint, I think, is something that really all the golf industry will be talking about moving forward, especially in urban areas. And speaking of just the idea of multi-purpose facilities, or, you know, getting more out of your acreage, Jason, it seemed like driving ranges this year, they've really begun to accept tech in a big way. You know, why don't you talk a little bit about some of the new concepts and where you saw them in your travels this year?
Well, the most interesting thing I stumbled into was in tiny little Campbell River, which is on Vancouver Island, a little logging and shipping and fishing village. And here, this new top tracer technology is a huge part of the business plan at Campbell River Golf and Country Club. So it's, you know, you can find this stuff, this tech anywhere, essentially, is what the message is, because it's pretty affordable to put in for the facility. And, you know, it could be a game changer for them, bring in a whole new crowd. The top tracer range is basically follows all your shots with cameras. The entire range is, you know, set up with cameras that track your ball. The technology is similar to what Topgolf offers, where you can play full rounds at Pebble Beach or Harbor Town. You can track your shots, figure out how long your clubs go, how long your driver carries, how far it rolls out, all those different kind of functions. So it can serve as an entertainment venue, or it can serve as a true driving range where you're trying to figure out your game. So that was really interesting. And, you know, they're growing like gangbusters. I talked to the CEO after I had my experience in Campbell River, and they expect to be in, you know, 25 countries by the end of next year. So they're really looking at a global growth.
Yeah, it seems like these, you know, not just Topgolf, but bringing the technology to the traditional driving range seems almost inevitable. Brad, do you think that from what you're hearing out there, do you see this, you know, really happening at a wide scale?
I wish they'd come to New England.
Sure.
We're waiting. You know, it's cold out here. I'd love to be able to hit golf balls and watch them and track them. And the new technology is really interesting. It, as Jason said, it's the high tech ball flight trajectory stuff in an entertainment setting now. So that'll appeal to the real, golf nuts, besides the ones who basically want to go out on a date and have a good time. And so, we're waiting up here in New England. But of course, we're always behind everything. So
I know that Honolulu, the Alawai golf course, which has always traditionally been a very busy golf course, they're trying to permit a kind of a top golf type concept out there. There are other municipal facilities. I know there's some permitting going on down in Southern California at a muni down there. I can see neighbors maybe not liking the idea of lights and facilities open later into the night, but it also seems like for munis that are struggling with their revenue and having to answer to city councils about, you know, numbers in the red, if they could get more cash out of, you know, an existing facility they have by putting some tech in it, it seems like a no-brainer. For me, even our trip to St. Andrews, they were just getting ready to debut TrackMan on their ranges. And so they were showing us the cameras out on the range, and each bay comes equipped with TrackMan stats. And you just, you know, flip on your phone and it's included in your bag of balls. So suddenly everyone at the range has an opportunity to look at their numbers like a PGA Tour pro. And I don't know if I need to know to know all that data. I don't know about you guys, but for it to be there and to just kind of have that offering, if it brings in more people, I think that could be really cool.
Well, there's a certain percentage, we all know, there's a certain percentage of total tech geek golfer, and maybe they put that stuff on their club and they know exactly how far they hit their 5-iron and they track all and download after the round. So I think if it brings people, you know, you'd have to do a benefit cost analysis. My sense is it's going to help. Interestingly enough, National Golf Foundation this year is starting to count people who are at the range and go to Topgolf in particular as a category. They're not included in golfers per se, the total count, but there's a sort of residual category. So they're keeping track of them. So they know that that's a potential of actual golfer, if we could say that.
Good. It seems like inevitable that there will be a tour pro or a good college player or maybe even a great high school golfer who says that they were introduced to the game at a Top Golf or something like that. So certainly something to keep an eye on. And I think, Brad, they'll be in the Northeast soon enough. So cross your fingers, they'll be there.
Land is expensive here, and we got a lot of regulations about putting up poles for fencing and for night lights. So I understand why that's, you know, all that stuff is relevant.
I wonder if Chelsea Piers would ever go to a Top Golf type thing.
Oh my God, that would be 24 hours nonstop there.
No kidding.
Yeah. Well, the top Tracer Range CEO Ben Sharp, he basically said they have a big announcement coming at the PGA Show in Orlando. So we will find out what the next generation for that business model is end of January. So it could be interesting to hear what he says.
Great. Well, we'll keep an eye on it, and we'll all be in the PGA Show in January. Brad, I've kind of given up on driving ranges. I'm more of like a golf guy now, and playing holes and trying to get better just by playing the game. And one of the ways to do that is short courses. And I know you spent some time at a few high profile short courses this year, at Big Cedar and also at the Cradle opening. Now, to me, short courses are interesting because they're kind of in vogue a little bit now. You're getting a lot of resorts beginning to commit to them, which I think is great. On the other hand, though, I mean, it's not a new concept. And over the years, really since maybe post-World War II, you've had a lot of short courses open, and a lot of them haven't made it. And so I'm curious, do you think the short course are they a fad now, or do you think we're going to start seeing more and more short courses come out, and do you think they'll last?
Well, first, let me just say the quote of the year that I had. I played in the opening of Mammoth Dunes up at Sand Valley in Wisconsin, and we played the name escapes me right now, but if I look at my yardage marker,
it's the Sandbox.
The Sandbox, yeah.
Sandbox.
They got 17 holes, and the holes are from 60 to 140, 50 yards. And someone asked architect David Kidd, who did the Sandbox, why didn't you do 18 holes? And he said, we didn't have enough room. I thought that was great. So they obviously, 17 holes, they didn't have enough room. Anyway, so I've played a lot of these, you know, even the Stream Song one, which was nestled into the side of the Black Course, which was six holes, Sylvie's Valley and the Cradle, which was fabulous. So here's my thinking. First of all, let's remember, nine-hole courses have always been part of golf. So the fact that you're going from a standard 18-hole golf course is not new. You know that 30% of all U.S. golf courses today are nine-hole courses. In the 20s and 30s, every little town had a nine-hole golf course, and half of the classic half of the design work that people like Tillinghast and Donald Ross were doing were taking nine-hole courses and expanding. All right, so then in the 60s, they tried this little experiment of executive course, which was a short 18-hole golf course. That didn't quite measure out. Anyway, my point is that everybody's recognized to some extent that 18 holes is a time-consuming thing. The real move toward these short courses, we forget to give them credit, is the first tee. They built 100 of these things starting in the mid-90s. Brandon Johnson, who now is the full-time architect and design associate with Arnold Palmer Golf Design, cut his teeth as a designer for the first tee and did dozens of them himself. So, and that was very popular as a training device. Now, the problem with some of those facilities is that they were freestanding and they didn't have a revenue stream. They were unattached. I think the short courses that we're seeing now are working because they are an alternative kind of after golf or instead of a full round. But you're at the resort, you're hanging out, you just pulled in at 4 o'clock, or you've played 18 holes or 36 holes and you want a couple of drinks and hang out and schmooze, or you bring, as I would do, my wife or grandkids and kind of, hey, let's go play some golf. We've done that at Bandon on the reserve. So it's a great thing as an add-on to an existing facility. I think as a standalone, they're a disaster. I think as an add-on, they're brilliant. And, you know, the Cradle is a great example of Pinehurst. It's a nine holes, I think it was, done by Gil Hands. It's right there. It's open to the public. They can play for $50. No reservation. Don't even have to have a hotel room. And it's jammed, and it's fun, and you go around in an hour. And it's brilliant. And I think they're going to work fine as an add-on. I don't think they work as a freestanding one. They don't have to be 18 holes. They don't have to be 9 holes. At the top of the rock is at a Big Cedar Lodge. There's a 9-hole Nicklaus course, but then Mountaintop is 13 holes of Gary Player. I hit everything from a lob wedge to a driver off those tees to those holes, and it was brilliant. Beautiful views. It was right next to, we had just played Ozark National, the Corcrenshaw, and then we went to the Gary Player 13 hole. So as an alternative and as a complement and as an addendum to an 18 hole round, or I think it's brilliant. I think it's going to work everywhere.
I had the experience last week, Brad, when I was in Mexico. I know you've been to Diamante, and
yeah.
I went out on the Oasis short course by Tiger Woods. There's 12 holes there.
Yep.
You know, almost everybody there was either a husband and wife, or I saw a gentleman with three what looked like kind of high school age girls. So a real mixed clientele. And I was out there working on my short game. I mean, it exposed me with those small greens and the paspalum grass. So, you know, they're definitely good facilities as long as they're in the proper spot and in the proper perspective.
Yeah, and that's an interesting conversion, because those are the old 12th and 13th holes of the Diamante Dunes course. And when they added the other holes on the beach front, they had that kind of to convert. So it worked really well. And it's, as you said, it falls into the range and it's really popular. So I think it's a great, inexpensive, and you can have a lot of fun both designing it and playing it.
You know, I'm working on a buddy's trip for 2019, and we decided on San Diego. And a lot of that had to do with the fact that for one of the days, I wanted to make sure that we could go play a short course. And San Diego is this market, Brad, that you talk about, where there's a lot of standalone short courses and executive courses.
Yeah.
And I was looking around, and there's like 5 or 6 to choose from. I played Goat Hill Park earlier this year, which was a lot of fun. And that's an example of one that's been totally redone as a muni. And they've really just got the ambiance right, and the greens are in good shape, and it's a good walk. But to me, you know, I'm going to be out there with my buddies, and some of them are college buddies who don't play a ton. And I want to make sure that, you know what, if they get beat up on, you know, whatever championship course we play that day, I want them to have a chance at a couple birdies that afternoon. And it seems to me that more and more destinations are realizing, even if it's not a resort, but destinations that are big like San Diego, there's a niche for the buddies group and for the people who, like you said, they get in on arrival day or they want to play 36, but they don't want 36 full length holes. It makes a lot of sense.
The best phone call I had all year, I called my wife up from Pinehurst and said I just played 9 holes and shot 31, and she was really impressed. So I didn't tell her that it was at the Cradle till I got home, but it's great. It's fun. You're putting for par and birdie on every hole.
Yeah. Pinehurst is one of those resorts that is investing like crazy, Brad. And I know you were out at number 4 this year as well. And I kind of look to this foursome of 5-star resorts in that area. You've got Pinehurst, you've got Sea Island, Sea Pines, which is of course home of Harbortown, and then I went to Kiowa Island around the time that they announced a really ambitious project for their grounds. And I think my takeaway visiting Kiowa and recently Sea Pines and Brad, with you going to Pinehurst and we sent someone to Sea Island this year as well, that the top end, that they're investing in the game. And you see at Pinehurst, they're investing in things like the short course and redoing number 4 and bringing it back to kind of a sandier look. Kiowa, they are putting in, you know, really high end kind of cottage and home rentals. They're redoing clubhouses for that kind of sports bar theme. What's interesting to me is that the top end is realizing, you know what, we can have these nice hotels, but we should also make sure that we have something for the buddies trips that want to stay under one roof. And we also better make sure there's a sports bar too.
At Pinehurst, they got the brewery now.
They do.
Which is, I got to say, a lot more fun than almost any other place in town there, except for the Pinecrest Inn. So now you got 2 places to go.
Jason, how about you? What did you see out in the world of resorts this year? And I know you visited a lot of places that were investing big and rebranding and things of that nature.
I think what it is twofold. You either have the arms race that you're talking about in the Southeast, where every 5-star property looks around and says, hey, they're doing something, we better do something too. Or in my case, a couple of my trips on the West Coast, I went to the Broadmoor. You and I were there for a couple of days. And then the old Furnace Creek Inn in Death Valley. These are both historic properties dating to the 1920s or earlier. And they're just all about reinvesting in what they have, making sure that their historic feel, flavor doesn't go away. So that means, you know, updating restaurant menus, you know, recreating ambiance, but still making sure that all of their historical touches, whether it be the tiled pool at and the Old West paintings at Death Valley, or, you know, just the Broadmoor, the iconic pink hotel, to make sure that they never lose that classy feel that people have loved over the years, but make sure that everything is updated and spot on for the modern traveler.
The Broadmoor blew me away. I didn't really expect the grounds, the kind of Olmsted planned out grounds. Reminded me a little bit like Pinehurst with mountains in the backdrop, and certainly every bit as luxurious and a really, really cool spot. Brad, I want to kick it over to private clubs and what you've been kind of seeing over on that end and memberships. So what's caught your eye there?
Well, actually, it's a similar theme. The big, how should I put this? In every city, there's one or two, or maybe some more, three or four, five clubs that are doing extremely well and investing smartly and intensively and steadily. And in those same cities, there are clubs, second, third tier, that are really struggling. So there's a segmentation of the market. So you see that flight to quality, just as you kind of referred to the major resorts. So that's one thing I'm seeing, where people have a lot more choices now, partly because of mobility of jobs. Initiation fees have come down, so people can choose a little more. The big places, you know, everything from Wingfoot, which rebuilt their entire golf course, for example, or Marion, good example. In Seattle, there's a slew of renovation, restoration work. That economy is booming in Seattle. Same thing in Charlotte or Nashville. So that's one thing. Second thing is you're seeing some really phenomenal, detailed, thoughtful restorations. And I'm talking about major historic rollbacks to, and Inverness is the outstanding one in Toledo, where they had kind of a hybrid. There was a Ross course overlaid with a little bit of the Tillinghast and Dick Wilson, and then Fazio's people did a kind of clumsy job there, famously. before the 79 Open, they finally brought a new guy in to completely gut the old Fazio stuff and reproduce the lost holes that had been abandoned. And the fellow who did it, Andrew Green, former shaper with McDonald and Sons out of Bethesda, Maryland, he's doing some fabulous work. He's got the job now to do a major renovation at Oak Hill. He's going to be doing, Huntington Valley in Philadelphia as well. Very interesting. So you're seeing... And then Oakland Hills is going to shut down for a year or two, and Gil Hans is going to do a major restoration to undo some of the modernization over the last 50 years and bring it back to the hybrid Ross Trent Jones course that it was. So you're seeing that kind of scale of major restoration, which I think is fascinating. So you're going to see a lot of that going on. And that's the biggest trend that I see. The other thing, of course, is everybody's upgrading their driving range. They're diversifying their middle and forward tees. You know, that's the biggest change there.
Yeah, Jason, you went to a few private clubs out west this year. Did you notice anything similar to what Brad's saying?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, the clubhouse, instead of it just being a giant, banquet facility, I think they want it to be a hangout place. So the restaurants are turning into sports bars, or they're, you know, getting rid of the old dark woods and kind of contemporizing everything to make it lighter and brighter and more welcoming to families. Kids are allowed to hang out a little more now. There's more activities for them, whether it be junior tennis or, junior programs on the golf course. So, you know, just basically contemporizing, if you've got the money or if you're being successful, you want to keep reinvesting to make sure you stay on top because the competition is really stiff.
And, you know, that takes very specific forms. For example, they're getting rid of formal dining, going to a much more relaxed, gluten-free menu with a lot more healthy choices, upgrading the swimming pool. They're converting the old boardrooms and putting in health, exercise, spa-type facilities and clubhouses. So some of these clubs are turning into daycare centers so that the folks can drop off their kids and safely be there all day.
You're talking my language now,
Brad. What's that?
I'm in the throes of early parenthood, and every day I think about, you know, how can I play golf and make sure my kids are taken care of? And so, yes, daycare, we need more daycare everywhere at golf courses.
Well, you ask any general manager, and now they're dealing with insurance for that kind of stuff, and it's a whole new ballgame for these clubs that are major centers of social activity. Where they have, if they're a family-oriented club, a golf-oriented club is not going to have these headaches. But if it's a family-oriented club, they want to attract the decision-makers who are largely women on family spending, they got to have this stuff. And Jason sees the same thing in private clubs everywhere, I'm sure.
Yeah, you know, the membership model to me is really interesting. The one place I went to this year, Boot Ranch out in Fredericksburg. Now, this is a place that opened in the early 2000s, you know, going for the big wigs, building, you know, man cave locker rooms and massive clubhouses. And, you know, they're a couple owners later, they've totally transformed into this multi-generational two up, two down membership. So if I buy a membership, the two generations below me and above me, we can all enjoy it together. And it's also like a shared housing model. So they've got these incredible, like $1.5, $2 million housing compounds, but they're selling them at about 1/8 or 1/9 of the year. So I can get in for $300,000 to $350,000, $400,000, and that includes a membership and a piece of these incredible houses, and the whole family becomes a member when they're there. And that's something I'm going to be keeping an eye on. I know Timbers is another brand that gets into the shared stuff a little bit, and I'll be curious to see if this shared model takes off, because, you know, Brad, as you say, you know, jobs are more mobile now, initiation fees have to come down, just because I'm not going to put $50,000 into an initiation if I'm going to move in a few years. That makes a lot of sense. But what else are you seeing on the membership front, and ways clubs are trying to get that innovation and get people to get more out of their membership?
I'll tell you what I'm seeing. It's very interesting, is these multiple membership or multiple access golf clubs. I'll give you a couple of examples. They're down in the south, mid-southeast, the McConnell Group. They've bought up a bunch of really fine courses, including Sedgefield in Greensboro. They just bought Holston Hills in Chattanooga. They've got about seven or eight of these, including Raleigh Country Club. And they've done a great job of fixing it up. If you're a member of one of those, you have membership privileges at the others. The Dormy Network is another one. They've bought up a string of courses as far as Arbor Links in Nebraska. And I'm going to think of the Fazio course in South Indiana. They just bought up, along with the Dormy Club in Pinehurst area. They've got eight or nine of these as well. And that's a membership. I think they also bought up, there's a Core Crenshaw course in Hidden Creek in Atlantic City they bought. So if you're a member of one of those, now you have a network all over the country. Thousand Greens is another entity where you buy into a membership, and that gives you access to a number of different participating clubs. The Outpost Club has been very busy, successful, doing events where you join and you have access to these very fine private clubs that no one had access to before, except the home members. And there's another one of those called Eligo Club that just developed, where you pay a membership and you have access as well. So that's, I think it's really interesting. I'm surprised there aren't more mergers of private clubs, but this is a great alternative where you join one and your access is, you know, really enhanced.
I know Club Corp has improved their footprint more and more, and that's very much a national model. You know, some places don't even have golf. It's, you know, just tennis and their urban clubs, but they have really a little bit of everything. And then I even think locally, a lot of the clubs here in Central Texas are owned by companies with four or five clubs. And so if you join one club, you get, you know, a round or two at, you know, a month at any of the other clubs. And so it's, to me, that makes all the sense in the world. If you're going to get kind of tired playing the same golf course over and over and over again, and I can get a Muni membership here for a fraction of the cost and play six courses, it only seems to make sense that if I join a private club, I should really be able to play anywhere I want in town.
Here's a new one for you guys. Brad, have you ever heard of a club called Perpadoc Club in Maine?
I might have heard of it once. I probably thought it was a version of a platypus. Sorry.
Yeah, it's got quite an interesting name, but it also has a really interesting membership category. They now have started a Twilight membership where you pay, you know, a fraction of a full membership, and you can play any day after 3:30. So for the member who's working all day long, or, you know, has kid duty and can't really sneak away for, you know, full rounds of golf, this is, I thought, a really interesting way for just the average Joe working guy to get him involved in your membership. You know, he or she only gets access at 3:30 or after, when your course is traditionally semi-empty or empty. So, you know, clubs are getting really creative these days to try and figure out ways to get people involved.
You think, well, you know, Yeaman's Hall in Charleston, which is a very fine, exclusive, you know, Rainer course, and in the winter it's really busy. They have summer memberships for unbelievably inexpensive access for the locals. I don't think Augusta National is going to do that, but it's a great way to fill up the tee sheet and to see when, you know, the demand for the indigenous membership isn't there. And it's a great revenue stream at very low additional cost, because you got to maintain the golf course anyway.
Brad, speaking of maintenance, you went to some turf conferences this year, and you're always hanging with superintendents. I know you were out on the grounds at Shinnecock bright and early at the U.S. Open. I'm curious, what are the hot topics in turf heading into 2019?
Well, I got to tell you this. The funny thing is, not only do I go to these or write them up, but I actually lecture at them. So I'm the go-to guy on architecture and about their career management. But when it comes to turf, my yard looks like hell. I don't know anything about it. And I know that these guys are experts. So I listen and take very careful notes about annual bluegrass control and all this other stuff. So, and one of the things you find out is that these guys work really hard. I've got an article coming out about this in Golf Odyssey. They work really hard, really long hours. They're like farmers. They're dependent on the weather. And they help each other. It's a really interesting profession. And so a couple of things that are going on. You're seeing, I would say, a lot less overseeding, of course, is in the Southeast and the Southwest. Water is a very precious commodity. It's expensive to get drinking water. Politically, it's a kind of hot topic in areas and regulation. So you're seeing the quality of turf in the winter now. You're seeing a lot more dormant golf courses, or sometimes in order to hide the dormancy of the Bermuda, you know, it shuts down when it gets cold. Instead of having to overseed it with perennial ryegrass, or annual ryegrass, perennial with the ryegrass, which costs a fortune. It's like 20% of your maintenance budget a year in the Southeast or Southwest is overseeding. So what, you know what they're doing? Instead of having a yellow golf course, which, by the way, is really cool, the ground's dormant, plays well, you paint the golf course green. So you're seeing that. They actually paint the golf course green.
Well, can you explain, I hear this a lot, can you explain exactly, like, what is this, what is paint? I mean, am I, like, going to Home Depot and asking for a gallon of emerald green? I mean, what exactly is coming out of the hose there?
I think it's a slightly less intense tone.
I hope so.
And it's obviously not water soluble. I don't know, actually, but they paint it. Sometimes you just paint the greens. But here's the point. The hybrid Bermudas, the new Ultra Dwarf, and they have a really fine blade. They perform just as well, really, as bent grass. That's what Pinehurst has converted. Pinehurst has converted its greens, as an example, to these new Ultra Dwarf Bermudas, and they roll and they're fine. They go off color a little bit. So I don't know what Pinehurst does, but at other courses, there's a certain kind of paint you use. I think it wears down. You have to put it out every few weeks, I guess. It's not a big deal. Now, the thing with dormant Bermuda is you try to keep the carts off of it, particularly in wet weather. because since the surface isn't growing, it's not absorbing water, and it stays wet. So, but in any case, you're seeing a lot more, I would simply say, dormant, off-color, tawny-colored, brownish, whatever, golf courses, or they're not overseeding and painting. That's one big thing.
You know, I got to say, Brad, like the overseeding in Texas, to me, it drives me up the wall. You know, it's one thing if I'm in Scottsdale and I'm coming from Chicago and I'm expecting, you know, green grass and $200 green fees, you know, okay, I get it. That's kind of what the market is there. But the munis here in Austin overseed, and you know, they don't jack up their prices. It's the same greens fee all year long. It might even be a little less dynamically. And so here I am in Austin, May through September, it's 105 degrees outside. And then finally the weather breaks and I'm so excited to go outside. Mm-hmm. I go out and I drive off the first hole. I hit my approach shot into the green and I get up there and I'm putting on shag carpet because it's ryegrass that was just laid down. And so for the next month,
right,
the conditions are awful. And it drives me up the wall.
That's the big problem. When you strip out your native Bermuda and replace it with an artificial turf surface for the winter, it's a 2-3 week transition in the fall. You've closed the course for a week, and it takes 2-3 weeks for it to grow, and it's watered like crazy, and it's absolute mush, and it has to stay really wet, otherwise it's not going to make it. So your management there is complicated. Then you have to strip out with kill the ryegrass and seed or let the Bermuda come back, and that's another 2-3 weeks. It's very expensive and it's terrible conditions. So, and you've then destroyed the inherent Bermuda because you're weakening it every year by killing it and letting it regrow, so that you never really establish a good base of Bermuda. So you're really working against yourself. And all of maintenance in those areas where they do it, it's all about managing the transition. It's not about cultivating the indigenous turf. And the best example of this is Augusta National, which is all their golf is played on overseeded ryegrass. They want it green, understandable, and they're closed in the summer anyway, so it doesn't quite matter. But anyway, we're seeing a lot more emphasis on letting the Bermuda just go dormant. It's a cool surface because the ball runs forever, and you got to manage the cart traffic, and you actually want to keep your carts off of that while it's transitioning. But and it's a little hard to find. I got to say, the golf ball is a little harder to spot, but it's a fine playing surface. So
that's why Callaway makes those soccer balls now and the yellow balls. So maybe it has to do with yellow. It coincides with all that.
That's right. Yeah. So that's a big change you're seeing. The other one I'm seeing is a lot more attention to letting wildly out of play areas go native because of GPS cart monitoring and all sorts of drone technology. They now know exactly on a golf course where people are and where they're not. And so you can identify areas that are literally out of play for 99% of the time. And you're seeing a lot more areas that are gone native. They're cultivating wild grasses, wildflowers. I'm seeing a big emphasis as well on bee friendly areas because of the whole issue about bee colony collapse. And golf courses are really great areas for cultivating apiaries. And so you're seeing that is part of the golf course too, a much more interesting habitat and native, plant mix.
Well,
so,
how does USGA, that's quite the hazard, a beehive colony on the right side. Well, we'll put it on the right side of the golf hole, 200 yards out, put a beehive. That's something for the architects to consider when they're building new courses.
I remember very clearly at Augusta National on the left side of the 15th hole, there was a big, big beehive hanging from a tree, and it was just, you stayed away from it. That's all. Everybody could. That was during the Masters, so they've got precedent for that.
Brad, what about labor? It seems like any time I talk to a superintendent, they can't fill their positions. And so is there anything going on that leads you to believe that there's some relief coming for superintendents just in the workforce?
A couple of things there. First of all, you're absolutely right. The cost of labor, the cost of healthcare, the lack of a replacement of laborers willing to come across the border to work for all sorts of immigration reasons has led to a shortfall of golf labor in the United States. So what you're seeing is much smarter, efficient management. You're seeing areas that are not being mowed as often in the rough in particular. One of the things you're seeing is an experimentation with robotic mowers. So if you don't have enough labor, convert to a kind of automatic mowing system. And these are being used on greens and fairways in an experimental mode now. But I think you're going to see a lot more of them. That way you can have your maintenance in the middle of the night when no one's around, rather than, as you know, it happens all the time, you try to get off early, get an early tea time, and then you're kind of held up because you're running into the maintenance crew. For a lot of reasons, I think you're going to see a lot more emphasis on robotic mowers on greens and fairways and tees.
You're speaking Jason's language now. He's over in Silicon Valley. So, Jason, you're going to have to keep an eye out for some automation on the golf course.
Yeah, we've already, you forwarded me the story that Presidio in San Francisco is already experimenting with robotic mowers on the greens. So sounds like they are definitely here and ready to take over the world, so to speak.
Yeah, and then we had that story earlier this year about the drone beverage cart, which that just seems to open up a can of worms. I don't know about you guys, but the drones really bother me because I've been to, you know, neighborhood swimming pools and there'll be a kid flying a drone and it sounds like a 100-pound bee above your head. Not exactly relaxing, and I can't imagine golfers really appreciating that, but I guess if it gets you your sandwich quicker, maybe there's something to be said for that.
Yeah, I don't know how well that turned out. That was in South Dakota, so if it goes outside of South Dakota borders, maybe it's something to watch, but I don't know that it will.
Jason, what about you did go to two really ambitious muni projects out that way this year. So where exactly is the innovation happening at Baylands and then the new South Course at Corica Park?
They both just had aging infrastructure, and it was either just the communities give up on golf or reinvest. They couldn't just, you know, do it half-baked like they had done for the last decade or two. So they both went all in, one in Oakland, near Oakland Airport, and one, in Palo Alto, which, is one of the most affluent communities in America. And, you know, they both kind of went for the same theme. They both wanted to be more playable, more interesting, more ground game. Corica Park is a little bit more of Australian sandbelt links, whereas Baylands is just kind of a more traditional links look with unique mounding and, you know, semi-blind shots and that sort of thing. I thought they were both really well done, really fun to play. It seems like the Golf Advisor reviews haven't been very strong. I think muni golfers don't really get the idea of interesting and clever architecture. You know, they just want to worry about costs, so they don't like that suddenly their $50 muni is now $75. But all in all, the courses are really good.
Jason, what about the clubhouse at Corica Park? I mean, we were talking about clubhouses earlier. And municipal clubhouses are traditionally an afterthought, but I thought it was interesting to see what Corica's doing.
Well, they have, you know, several buildings there. So it's kind of a unique model there where one building is, just for teaching, and it's over by a little putting course and par three course. And then they have kind of a separate restaurant building. And then their main pro shop is now a Lynx Soul store, if you will. So, you know, it's not just golf balls. In fact, there's very little golf clubs in it other than putters. You have skateboards, surfboards, you know, kind of the hip Southern California lifestyle theme going on. A lot of Seamus gear from Oregon. So they really try to make it more cool and interesting than just your normal average pro shop. And I really thought it was a great concept. I hope that they have success there and can find home for a couple of more places like that.
Yeah, I think it could do well. The munis in my town are, you know, the clubhouses are really nothing special at all. The merch, except at, you know, Lions, they've got some cool shirts there. But, you know, the merch and just the overall experience, they really kind of go bare bones. And I don't think they think about I really just think about munis in general, and like they're just not maximizing their facilities whatsoever. And so whether it was, you know, operating their own clubhouse with more perks or leasing it out to people who know what they're doing, like Linksoul, I think there's just so much room to run on that regard.
And to go along with that Linksoul story, you know, they redid their entire patio, so now they have fire pits and they have music pumping out there. So I think just that whole vibe and ambiance, you know, makes it more fun to go to the golf course. It's not quiet and stuffy. It has that hip vibe that younger, different clientele are looking for.
Yeah, it's a great first impression, yeah. I think. It makes some of the younger people think they belong, and then it's cool to be there. This is around the time of year, Jason, where Jason kind of becomes doomsday Deegan around here. For the last few years, at the end of the year, we do a wrap-up of notable courses that closed. And, of course, there's really been no shortage over the last few years of options. But Jason, I'm curious. You know, you've been doing some research over the last few weeks on notable courses that have closed. Are you detecting any themes or trends in terms of courses that aren't making it?
You know, it's a very morbid holiday tradition. You know, one minute I'm wrapping presents, and the next minute I'm, finding another golf course that I played like 10 years ago has closed. So it's very strange dynamic. I feel like in doing this story since 2015, you know, 4 years now, that San Diego has been really hard hit. And the same with Central Ohio. Really interesting that, you know, San Diego has all the glitz and glamour of Torrey Pines and, you know, Madeiras is a great property. So those high end places are doing fine. But you know, kind of the more inland courses that are hidden in the canyons that depend on local play, the water costs and, you know, the cost of doing business in California with minimum wage hikes and that sort of thing are just decimating these places. Central Ohio, I think, just a similar dynamic in that if you're a really diehard golfer, you belong to a club and there's no shortage of, you know, top 100 clubs around Columbus and those places. So a lot of the middle of the road and mom and pop courses are closing. They just can't handle the loss of players and, you know, the seasonal business. You know, if they have a bad spring or a bad fall, it really damages their bottom line.
Yeah, I've spent some time in Central Ohio, and there was actually a few years ago I was visiting. I was really just looking for some good daily fees in that area because I was familiar with what was then called Longaberger, now Virtues, and that was fairly outside Columbus on its own. And one of the courses I went to was around the corner from Muirfield Village. It was Riviera, and the Italian Golf Association owned it. And I remember walking in like, hey, I'm here to do an article on your course. They're like, why? We're closing. And then there's a couple other courses I went to that, you know, they were $18, $20 golf courses, and you kind of do the math in your head, and you're thinking, okay, like, here's a course on, you know, even if it's kind of rural, this doesn't seem like a business model that's going to work.
Yeah, you know, it's these stories that I do always turn up courses, you know, really good courses all over the place. Last year, Old Silo in Kentucky, everybody said they loved it, but yet they didn't have enough golfers to make it. This year, a really, really high-end course, Adena, in Central Florida. In Ocala, surprisingly closed. So, you know, you never know who's not going to make it and who's going to make it. There's high-end courses closing, but I'd say the majority of them are kind of middle-class to lower-middle-class courses that just the owner is getting up in age. They maybe want to sell it to retire, or they just don't have the money to reinvest.
Brad, what do you think about that? I know you've had some thoughts on you know, these types of courses that, and, you know, is there any way out for them?
Well, first thing is that we're only talking about 1% of the inventory. So that's not surprising or disastrous or, you know, it's not calamitous, whatever. It's an interesting thing. Obviously, the National Golf Foundation tracks it. My understanding is that the net number of closures this year has gone up a little bit. But it's really around 150 to 200 every year. What worries me is I think that a lot more courses would close if municipalities and zoning would let them. But it's hard to close a golf course because it's an open space, and sometimes it's a floodplain for flood control, and there are all sorts of issues about converting it.
One of the trends I've noticed is municipal courses would be closing probably by the buckets, but because they are, governed and everybody has a say in their future, it takes longer for these things to happen. And so, municipalities, cities, counties, whatever, they'll do studies for 2 or 3 years, then they'll talk about it for a year, and then maybe they'll end up deciding to close or reinvest. So all these courses that are supposedly on death's door, they might have a survival plan of 5 to 10 years before anything actually happens.
Jason, I think you've absolutely nailed it. It's really an interesting issue. It's probably something we ought to write about, because a lot of these courses might make for good real estate, except they're sitting on wetlands when they were built. There were no wetlands issues back in the 20s and 30s. They were defined only in the 60s and 70s. So now all of a sudden you got a golf course that's not making it, but it can't be converted over to real estate because it won't meet the requirements of uplands. And so the owners are stuck with it. And I've seen the other thing is local opposition to conversion because they want their open space. So a lot of interesting issues on the closure part.
Yeah, we saw that news drop very recently about the ocean course at Amelia Island, where this yep. was they kind of closed it overnight and just started bulldozing it, and lo and behold, they've been ordered to reopen due to some contract language in the property. So yeah, it's you'd like to think that it'd be just easy to shut down a golf course, but it's actually pretty tough.
Well, when you have a company that sells real estate on the basis of view sheds that are going to be preserved of this beautiful expanse, and now you just take it away from them, you've got grounds for a lawsuit. Yeah, it's interesting.
Well, guys, I think we're winding down. I don't want you guys billing me overtime for your holiday work. So let's go ahead and close on a note of. Is there a particular issue that you're really looking at in the game of golf in 2019? Jason, let's start with you.
To me, it's about how many new courses are we going to see, because you have all these architects that are fighting for work, want to remain relevant. What courses make sense to build and which ones don't? So, every year I go to a new course, I consider it a giant blessing because I just don't know how many more new ones I'm going to see. So every time there's language that a new one is coming out, that perks my interest. And I'm curious to see, how unique or interesting they are, because they definitely have to be different to survive in today's, in attracting golfers and making sure they stay relevant long term.
Yeah, I think that brand new golf courses on new land is really rare right now. Maybe a little less rare are just total rebuilds on existing courses. It's funny, here in Austin, we've actually seen a fair amount of new courses coming out. We had Kissing Tree open this year just down the road in San Marcos. We're obviously in a huge boom down here in terms of residential properties, and now Discovery Land is bringing a Fazio course out by the Salt Lick. For those of you who know Austin, it's just southwest of town. For me though, I am just coming back to the Muni issue because it seems like if a Muni isn't investing, and whether that's a renovation of the golf course or if it's just upgrading facilities or getting a Top Golf on their driving range, if they're not doing that, they're probably bleeding money, and citizens are starting to wonder, why the course is there. And even just in my backyard, my home course, probably within the next couple months, there's going to be a decision on whether or not it lasts. And I'm talking about Lyons Municipal in Austin. It's a 1924 golf course with a lot of history on it. And it's a tough thing because here's a course that's sitting on 140 acres that's probably got a 9-figure valuation on it if they allow development. And so do we allow $25 green fees on a $100 million property? Does that add up? And then you've got Ben Crenshaw living around the corner just chomping at the bit to renovate this place. And I know his architect rival, Tom Doak, is about to get the green light at Memorial Park just down the road. So you see Houston totally investing in their munis with Gus Wortham this year and very likely Memorial Park. But then up here in Austin, you have this is a very historic golf town with Harvey Pennick, and it's kind of jewel muni that I liken a lot to Brackenridge Park down in San Antonio. There's going to be a decision between the university, who are the landholders, and the city in terms of what can the city offer that's fair value for what many consider priceless green space. So I'll be on that beat a little bit. There's going to be some interesting council meetings and backdoor discussions for muni going forward. So Brad, how about you? What are you looking at in 2019?
I'm going to watch TV, and I'm waiting for the first drivable 5-par on tour. And what I mean by that, of course, is the distances that are going on. There are 12 guys now who are averaging 320. The tour average went up 4 yards. This is relevant because even to everyday golfers, we're going to see a lot more debate about so-called bifurcation, different golf ball, separate tournament rules, whatever. I don't think USGA is going to roll back the golf ball for fear that it will be perceived as an attack on the average golfer, even though the average golfer doesn't get the distance that they would like out of the ball, whereas the tour player does. It's a complicated issue, but I think we're going to see that more and more on TV and on tour. And I'm hoping that they end up with a decision to go with a tournament golf ball, because there's precedent for bifurcation in terms of how the rules are applied between amateurs and pros, and how they're policed and self-imposed. So I think that's going to be an ongoing issue. But I don't think the average golfer is going to stand for it. And I think the manufacturers have a case there. So I think it's going to be a big issue.
Yeah, that's going to be a messy. There's really not going to be any way that satisfies everyone. So it's going to be a messy issue. It's an issue that is essentially dominating golf Twitter right now. And it's that drumbeat's really only going to increase as you know. Who knows if 18 at Kapalua is downwind and Cam Champ's in the field at some point, hell, he could drive the 18th at Kapalua with the right wind, maybe. I don't know. But well, yeah, it's just incredible.
That's a good example. That hole 660. When I played it, I hit driver 8-iron, but I hit a 3-wood in between. So, you know, I'm your average 13 handicap. So I think it's hard to relate to what's going on the tour. The difference between those guys and the average, even the average great golfer, is so amazing, and it's getting worse. So I think courses are adapting. It's nice to see a lot of golf played at 6,200 yards and forward tees at 4,300 yards and 4,800. So that's all healthy, and we're going to see more of that. And I think the average golfer has adapted a lot more. There's some resistance, but I'm seeing more golf played at the appropriate distance for everyday players, which I think is great. That means more fun, more interest, and more player retention, which is what I really worry about.
And pace of play, right?
Oh, yeah.
Well, guys, let's rest up over the holidays. Before you know it, it'll be the PGA Show. We'll be there and talking even more stuff in 2019 and trends to look out for. So thanks again for joining us.
You too, guys. Take care.
Thanks. Take care.